The Invocation, a novel by D. Vincent DiPaolo. Chapter 2, Surin's Flat. It wasn't long after our first meeting that I invited Schofield to view my one treasure, a folio of 12th and 13th century miniatures I'd liberated from the library during a power outage. Flushed and sweating atop the five-story walk-up, Schofield had seemed to fill my small apartment entirely. For lack of a closet, I'd hung all my clothing from the window sash, imbuing the space with a wan, subfusc light. A bit bohemian, I knew, but it helped me keep the place neat. I had a narrow cot, a bookshelf, a desk, a chair, and a bureau with a water basin. That was all. Paul noted the basin, paused mid-step, then looked around quizzically, the question obvious in his gaze. The bathroom is down the hall.
Oh, well,
he said vaguely. I seated him at my desk, holding my breath as the second-hand cafe chair groaned under his weight, and then presented him with the ancient tome. Look at this binding, Paul, I said, caressing the little book. The detail on the spine. That's gold leaf and lead, you know. This is true craftsmanship. A lost art in itself. Here, feel the weight of it. Go ahead. He took the book as though it were made of ash.
Quite.
At first he perused the plates without much real interest. I could tell by the way he paid more attention to the texture of the vellum than to the artwork itself. But then he turned to a Romanesque panel of two archangels saving a soul, and I saw his whole demeanour change. His jaw moved side to side, his breathing became heavy, and he unconsciously let out some of his noxious intestinal build-up. He looked around then, embarrassed, I suppose, and said, though decided would be a more apt way of putting it,
"This is all very fascinating, Surin, but, and please don't take this the wrong way, this apartment isn't worthy to stable a horse, much less a scholar of your talents. I can hardly breathe in here, let alone concentrate. Come, you must move in with me. My rooms are far too grand. I feel quite ridiculous wandering about like some modern-day lord of the manor. And to think you've been paying money to live here."
Chapter 3. Emma. In fact, Paul's rooms were palatial compared to mine. They occupied the entire upper floor of a small building on Margate Street, just blocks away from the conservatory, and very convenient to the cafe. I was graced with not one, but two rooms in my suite as well as my own bathroom. The great room and piano studio separated us, but even so I could hear the rumble of Paul's intestines and the grating rasp of his snore easily through the intervening walls. It was but a small price to pay for such luxury. Indeed, he never let me pay a cent toward the rent.
"What rent?"
he once said.
"My uncle owns the building."
In retrospect, however, had I needed to pay, perhaps I would have moved out quite soon. For in addition to his constant noodling at the piano, Paul kept a dream journal. He believed his greatest work came to him through his subconscious, and almost nightly he would wake in the throes of creation, humming or whistling, and scribble frantically in his bedside notebook, trying to capture the elusive symphony that haunted his dreams. Then he would fall back to bed, fitful and angry at the muse which teased him, for he could never quite reconstruct what he heard to his satisfaction, yet nevertheless returning directly to a deep, reverberant sleep. I would slip on my spectacles, peer out at the clock tower, sigh and set to work upon my papers. In those years, Paul was either completely absorbed in his music, feverishly filling his oversized score paper by the piano. He preferred to hear the vibrations of the notes even though his inner ear was quite up to the task of working in silence. Or he was urging me to come out on the town with him, eating and drinking voraciously, paying thick-limbed streetwalkers to join us, joking and laughing with them, openly fondling them, and then violently defending their honour against anyone drunk or unwise enough to cast a leering eye in their direction.
"They're still girls, Surin,"
he once said.
"No different from others, just in greater need. I feel it my duty to support them."
I watched and wondered. Sure, he seemed genuine, and he did treat them well, but I knew too how much the condition of his bowels embarrassed him, how very awkward it made him feel at times. It was during one such excursion that I met my Emma. She noticed me sitting meekly at the edge of a large party, a glass of champagne in front of me and a massive tome, The Glory of Byzantium, open on my lap, just barely illumined by the two extra candles I'd appropriated from an adjacent table. Paul had invited three stoutly built ladies, I've forgotten their names, and three mutual friends, Epstein, Brandywine, and Nelson. We played at affecting the styles of 19th century intelligentsia in those days, calling each other by our surnames, wearing waistcoats and neckcloths, smoking hand-rolled cigarillos. So there we were, the seven of them gaily talking bawdy and drinking bottle after bottle of the hall's finest champagne, me with my art book and spectacles trying to concentrate, but being constantly drawn to the untended underarm of one of Paul's companions. When up strode Emma, tall and willowy in her long grey skirt and mauve sweater.
Trying to hide the Middle Ages from your friends? How very medieval of you.
She sat down beside me, hefted the book onto the table and began leafing through the pages.
Don't worry,
she said conspiratorially.
With me, a girl, a non-professional girl, no less, by your side, they don't dare chide you about the book. Ah, here it is.
And she pointed a tobacco-stained finger to a folio of The Metamorphosis, a late 12th century mosaic of the risen Christ in gilded bronze, marble, lapis lazuli, glass, and wax on wood.
There's the only piece worth mentioning in your whole perspective-challenged period.
I'd seen it before, also known as the Transfiguration. Few objects in late Byzantine art were as well known. I gave her credit for knowing the most obvious, though lurid, to my mind, example of the style because I could see she meant well, that she was trying to be agreeable, and also, perhaps mainly, because she was so very lovely. God, I hope she doesn't think I'm Paul. More than once, some stranger being led to table by a hostess or waiter had bowed and offered their hand to me, my spectacles, thinning hair, and meager belly being all the confirmation they needed that I was the artiste, and the hulking hairy figure across the table was perhaps some labourer or servant. Now it occurred to me that someone may have mentioned that Schofield was at this table, and perusing the group, this lovely vision of a girl had decided I was he. As if reading my mind, she asked,
Your friend, he isn't Paul Schofield the composer, is he?
I followed her gaze. A less fortunate moment could hardly have been chosen. Paul, nostrils flaring, his bottom teeth thrust forward like a goat's, was just slipping his hand through the armhole of his escort's dress to fondle her swarthy, pimpled breast. Emma turned out to be a delightful companion, even if her preference was for the high renaissance of Da Vinci and Buonarroti. She was tone-deaf, brilliant, and smoked so continuously that her sense of smell was almost completely destroyed. Paul approved of her wholeheartedly. She soon became the centre of our world, and it was a normal thing for Paul or myself to say on a Saturday night, What shall we do? And the other to answer, I don't know. What does Emma suggest? Thus she took control of our social lives, freeing us from the worry and the stress. It was she, in fact, who began the soirees.
Oh, that's so very George Sand of you, Emma.
Paul had cried when she first suggested the idea. But he didn't object. It made sense. After all, why should we bother to go out when the party could come to us? The flat was enormous, and Paul had enough money to hire a chef and even a couple of serving girls for those evenings. Marta, the waitress from the Café Select, being a regular among them, of course. In no time at all, a wonderful mix of musicians and artists were gathering every weekend, sometimes spontaneously picking up random instruments from Paul's vast collection to improvise in wild, aleatoric rumblings, and other times reading through chamber works, occasionally from the repertoire, but more often by Paul himself, written the day or week before, either on a whim or planned specifically for the musicians invited that night. We were making a history of our own, combining art and music, food and wine and spirits. We made a point of finding the true wormwood-laden absinthe, smoking tobacco, hashish, opium, dancing, fighting, laughing, and even once partaking of a groping candlelit orgy. But work always came first. Emma made sure of that. An unfinished paper would cause the immediate cancellation of any party, no matter how close to the date. For her, these events weren't just parties. We weren't some miniature frat house, after all. They were opportunities. She truly believed in the importance of other people, that each stranger had the potential to change another's life, another's world. It is perhaps ironic, then, that it was Emma, my salvation, who was responsible for Paul meeting Carlo Molino, or, as I later came to think of him, the devil. Until that time, Schofield had never taken any notice of his fellow composers. They were like seeds blowing on the wind while he was an aged oak, roots firmly planted in the soil of the other greats. Then Molino came on the scene, a highly touted composer from Italy said to have won all of the country's major awards. Young, too, younger than Paul, and a composer of such original though painfully dissonant music that it made me wonder if he was deaf, or like some other species, a dog perhaps. He heard things differently. Tones out of range from the rest of humanity. Emma thought it would be interesting to invite him. He appeared one night, score in hand, and performed a startling duo for piano four hands with an unsuspecting young Korean pianist, whom he crowded and appeared to fondle throughout the whole extremely complex Gordian knot of a piece. The party had faltered then at the dismissive ending, an anticlimax, the pause of a woodpecker's bill, the woodpecker having died from exhaustion, apparently. Everyone had looked to Paul, and Paul, who had no patience for mediocrity, had taken in the round-headed Italian, the slim, worried Korean, and the still resonating tetrachord in one long instant, and, through some mental alchemy known only to him, had decided it worthy, declaring,
"Well done, my man, sehr gut."
Thus, Molino had been accepted, the first and only other composer ever to have been privy to the magic of the soiree. "Did you really like that piece of his?" I asked after the guests had left. Paul only stared back at me then, a strange, faraway look in his eyes. He farted and then shuffled off to bed. Schofield began his obsession with Faust a few weeks later, following the music from Gounod to Berlioz to Liszt, and eventually to Schnittke. Then, in an attempt to understand the vast difference in settings, he went to the Word, reading Marlowe, Goethe, and finally, Mann. He dragged me along, of course, not being content to delve so far into a subject without an equally informed interlocutor. I didn't mind. The tale held something seductive for both of us. I appreciated Faust's yearning for knowledge, Paul, his delight in the flesh. We were in agreement from the beginning, preferring Liszt's treatment over Berlioz's, not being able to sit through the tedious Gounod, and being completely repulsed by the Schnittke. In the literature, we both preferred Marlowe's powerful, straightforward approach best, agreeing that his description of hell, "Think'st thou that I, who saw the face of God and tasted the eternal joys of heaven, am not tormented with 10,000 hells in being deprived of everlasting bliss," was perhaps the most evocative, even in comparison with the vivid portrayals of hell from Dante's Inferno. We agreed that Goethe's version was too multi-layered, a bit too complex for the retelling of the same tale, albeit with the ambiguous redemption at the end. Did he escape? We both believed he did not. However, we were divided when it came to Mann's Dr. Faustus. For the first time, we found ourselves inside the story. There was an uncanny similarity between Mann's narrator, Serenus Zeitblum, and myself, just as there was with his protagonist, a composer named Adrian Levacun, and Paul. Yet whereas the similarity caused me an almost physical distress, Paul was simply angry.
"It's too allegorical,"
he complained, frustrated by the ending. He didn't want the story to be about Germany. For him, it had to be real. He was Adrian Levacun, only he didn't need any pact with the devil to achieve artistic satisfaction.
"What is this fascination mankind has with success and failure, anyway?"
he growled. He could be naive like that, in many ways. "Paul, perhaps not for you," I said, "but I assure you, success is a constant struggle for the everyday man. The commoners, if you will." He gave me a searching look, then his black eyes twinkled and he blurted,
"Ha! You had be there for a minute, Serenus."
"Please. I'm serious. And don't start calling me Serenus." He sighed, apologizing with a look, and then grasped my hands with crushing force.
You will stand by me, though, won't you, brother, whatever the outcome?
I pulled away. Don't be so maudlin. Of course I'll stand by you. Whatever that's supposed to mean. He often spoke that way, alluding to a not-so-distant future where, invariably, he was gone, and it was up to me to organise his legacy, to set things straight. For a man seemingly unconcerned with success, he was uncommonly concerned with how he would be remembered. You have been listening to The Invocation by D. Vincent DiPaolo. Follow along with the book, available in the Kindle store. See the link in the show notes, and do stay tuned for the next chapter.